name is Tiger Howard DeVore, and I'm a PhD in clinical psychology and a certified sex therapist. And I've been working with people who are sexually different for 30 years and advocating for the rights of people who are sexually different for all of that time. And even before then, I was working with the Advocate newspaper in San Francisco at the time of the Dan White murders and the Dan White trials and the riots in the streets. And then all the California initiatives to prevent gay and lesbian people from being able to get housing or jobs or to be legal to fire them on the basis of their sexuality. And then work with the GPAC on getting gender included in some of the human rights legislation that's been going on in Washington, D.C. And all along with ISNA, the Intersex Society of North America, and with other groups around the world, trying to get some kind of recognition for people who are sexually different from the standpoint of how they're born, that they're intersexed or between the sexes, or have ambiguous genitalia, or different kinds of chromosomes or gonads. And on that basis, this society tries to force them by surgery before they're a year old to conform to either male or female heteronormative kinds of stereotypes that come right down to things like measurements of genitals and making sense of how it is that people can be made to function as males or females. So it's quite a depth of work over that period of time.
Is it okay if we start with the specifics in terms of what it is to be intersex?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. What intersex means is that the child, when they're born, is born somewhere between male and female. And the reason why that happens is that the resting state of mammal tissue is female. So if once a child is conceived, nothing were to happen to that fetus, it would be born looking female. And that doesn't matter from the standpoint of the chromosomes or anything else. What matters is so much of the hormonal effects on the child. So it moves, the child develops basically from female to male in many, many steps. So the genitals change conformation, they literally change how they look and how they function over the time of gestation. So if there's a stopping in that masculinization, especially the external genitalia, then that child is noticed often at birth as being between the sexes, having ambiguous genitalia. And that, in the main, is what we call intersex people.
What has been traditionally the procedure in terms of the medical establishment in relationship to intersex kid babies?
When those children are born, if they're identified as having intersex genitals at birth, because sometimes they just don't notice and they think they're females, and sometimes they just don't notice and they think they're males, depending on what the syndrome is. Sometimes those kids are raised for the first year or two or three in whatever sex they were announced when they were born. And then later on, something happens medically or something happens when somebody looks closely at the child to let them know that they don't have regular genitalia or that things aren't functioning or moving along in the way that everybody thought that they would. So at that point, the doctors are called in and the experts come in and they make sense of what they're going to do with this kid. If the child is identified at birth, then surgery happens within the first year. Parents are told what the guessed at sex of assignment is going to be. So they guess it's going to be a girl, or they guess it's going to be a boy, and they tell that to the parents, and then the child is set on this kind of treadmill of surgery and treatment to make that child as much of a boy or as much of a girl as it possibly can be. Sometimes it doesn't work out so well, and sometimes the kids rebel, and they change sex in teenage or adulthood, or in some cases they just take their lives because they can't handle the confusion and all the medicalization. There's a whole set of outcomes that come along with that.
What are the conditions that set for the medical establishment to function within this kind of binary logic of wanting to modify or reassign the sex to either male or female? Why would it be a problem to just wait and see?
Because this is what all of us who are born intersex are trying to get the medical establishment to do, to wait and to let the child make a determination about what their sex of identity is, so that when they're 3, 4, or 5, they begin to tell you if they think they're a boy or a girl, and they show you by the kinds of ways that they pick toys or how they refer to themselves or the kinds of clothing they prefer. And by the time they're 11, 12, 13, they're making decisions about what kind of puberty that they want to have. Do they want to have a feminizing puberty, end up looking like a girl? Do they want to have a masculinizing puberty, end up looking like a boy, or something else? Do they want to have a natural puberty that is natural to their own personal physiology and kind of go with that? Because there are some kids who will identify as being neither male nor female, and that's very, very difficult for parents. It's very, very difficult for heterosexual people because they want their kid to be heterosexual too, and they want their kid to be either male or female and grow up like they did and find an opposite sex partner and have children and a family and have that kind of life. But that doesn't always fit for an intersex person.
What you're suggesting is that it is too much of a risk for parents to wait and see as it pertains to sexual norms in society?
It isn't so much that it's too much of a risk, it's that it's a great psychological challenge to be told you have to raise your child understanding that your child may tell you that in a few years it doesn't feel like the sex that you think it is. It doesn't fit the name that you've given it. It won't wear the clothes that you want it to wear. It won't play with the toys that you want it to play with. It's going to have a different feeling about itself, and it will tell you what those feelings are. And in order to preserve genital functioning and genital sensation, we're not going to do surgery, we're not going to give this kid hormones, we're not going to do anything that's going to change this kid until the kid has the chance to make that decision for themselves. It's called informed consent. Instead of having something done to you without your knowing about it, you get to tell about it. You get to find out in advance if you want to have this treatment or this surgery. And with little kids, we don't do that, especially around their genitals.
What would the choice be for parents in that regard if they choose to start to raise the kid either male or female, but then something changes along the process? What is the advocacy from the part of the intersex society in regards to that? Is there something as raising a baby gender neutral for the first years?
Very few parents are willing to do that in this society. Most parents want to have a provisional assignment of sex so the child can have a social identification, so the child isn't stigmatized and teased too badly when it goes out into general society. I work with one woman who's homeschooling her kid so that kid can grow up without having the pressure of the society around it to have to identify as male or female. But that's a rare parent, very rare parent. If we put this kid out in general society, everybody's going to say, are you a boy or are you a girl? Are you a little boy or a little girl? And that kid doesn't want to answer that question because doesn't really have an answer for that question until they're ready. You know, and usually they're ready pretty early. They'll tell you pretty quickly, either by showing you or by telling you straight out. So, yeah, the parents have to be able to deal with sometimes a provisional assignment, which means we're going to dress this kid like a girl, we're going to call it a girl, but you need to know. It may tell you later, it's a boy, or it's not a girl and not a boy. And then we have to deal with supporting the family through what those choices look like as the child matures, as the child faces puberty, as the child faces development of sexual identity.
What are the different syndromes of intersex?
There are many. The most common ones are congenital virilizing adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, and that happens in a female pattern. Usually in female pattern babies, so it's XX chromosomes, and those kids can be born with internal genitals that are female, so they have the uterus and fallopian tubes and the inside of the vagina, but they have kind of a penis on the outside, looks just like a penis, except for the scrotal sacs don't have testes in them. The scrotal sacs are kind of empty usually, and they have ovaries up in the abdomen. So these kids will grow up being raised male. They're being told that they're male. Their puberties may be masculinizing, relatively. And these kids, when they hit menstruation, they menstruate once a month and they bleed through their penis. And I've had a few patients like that. They identify as male. They feel like males. They often do better with testosterone hormone replacement than estrogen hormone replacement. And they often identify as heterosexual males, and their penises work, but they don't make sperm because they don't have those kinds of gonads. In another syndrome, there's another syndrome called androgen insensitivity, and these are people with male pattern chromosomes, XY chromosomes, and they are born with no sensitivity to androgens. Androgens are the hormones that make the baby look male and female, but their tissues, all the tissues in their body, don't respond to androgen at all. So they come out looking just like female babies. They have internal genitalia of men. They have a shallow vagina, so the inside part of the vagina never develops. They have no uterus or fallopian tubes. They almost, and they're hairless, except on their head, because it takes androgens to make body hair. And they often identify very, very much as women, even though they have 46XY male chromosomes. They're often heterosexual identification, see themselves as women, but they're infertile. They can't have kids. So those are kind of the two extremes. Mm-hmm. If you look at this from the standpoint of the chromosomes, there are people out there with 47 instead of 46 chromosomes. So in every cell, their sex chromosomes are XXY. So it's male and female, both in the same, in one cell. And these people are born with what looks like a penis, usually a full penis outside, but it's infantile in size, and at puberty doesn't grow a lot because they don't have really the hormones for that to happen. They tend to have a female fat distribution, so they're a little curvier. Sometimes they develop breasts because they don't have a lot of virilizing hormones. The long bones in the legs and arms don't, they don't grow normally. They get too long because it takes male hormones to close off the ends of those bones, so they stop growing. So you'll see these people and they'll be 7 feet tall. Okay, they can be very, very tall people. But they identify kind of between the sexes. A lot of them identify as male. Some of them identify as in between. A rare group of them identify really as female. So it's quite a mix if you look at it from the standpoint of the chromosomes. There are several other syndromes that kind of fit between these extremes, like hypospadias, which is it's usually an XY kind of birth difference that results in ambiguous genitalia. It's probably the most common congenital difference in our species, and it happens more often than anything else in the birthing suite. But we still don't really know how to deal with it when it happens. We don't know what to tell parents. And the conventional wisdom is that hypospadias is easily repaired and can be done quickly and before the child will ever know about it. And when parents are promised one or two surgeries, it can result in as many as more than 20 surgeries mm-hmm. over time. Surgical technique improves over time, but we are still cutting into flesh with steel and stitching it up with something, either silk or something that dissolves. So as much as the techniques have improved, we're still cutting into fresh flesh with steel. And that means scarring, and that means you can't tell exactly how it's going to heal. That means it will not be as flexible as regular skin, and that means it will not have blood supply or nervous feeling. So you really have to consider that when you're telling these parents, oh, we're just going to cut this kid up a little bit and he'll be fine. Can't really promise that.
That's physical scarring, but I also imagine it's emotional scarring.
When the kids, the doctors will tell you the kids are too young to remember. And if they really are younger than 1 year old, typically they will not remember. But many, many kids have terrible traumatic memories of what it was like to be in the hospital. And they'll report this in therapy. They'll mention it when they're kids, and the parents, of course, don't want to talk about that. It's a scary thing to admit to. It's a scary thing because the parents have no preparation for how to deal with their children's memories of having been abandoned by them in a scary place where they got hurt by people who they didn't know. And that's the way the kid remembers it, that this, you know, really scary thing happened to them where their parents kind of like left them in this big building where they got hurt really badly down there where they can't talk about. And, you know, it's a bad childhood memory.
What is the historical trajectory, if you will, of intersex people up to modern times in which they become subjects of medical practice?
Science, yeah.
Was this always so, or how has this changed historically?
Well, we see from reviewing history that it has always been so. That every society that records intersex people as part of their birth population have different traditions about how to deal with these kids. So when we're looking at warlike societies that have to raise warriors and have to raise breeding females, when they get a kid who clearly has a genital deformity, in warlike societies, like in Spartans and in Apache Indians. And in societies like this, they throw the kid off a cliff and kill it, or they leave it on a hillside to die, because that kid is not going to be a warrior, and that kid is not going to be a mother. It's not going to give them more warriors. So the child is destroyed right after birth. In other societies that are more agrarian, that tend to have more of a spiritual element to them, like the Zunis, like to some extent the more ancient East Indian societies. There's a number of examples of these. The New Guinea, Papua New Guinea indigenous peoples, they have a whole set of traditions where they raise these people to be shamans and healers and spiritual teachers. These are the people that get given a special place because they're special looking and they're different from the men and the women who have assigned roles. So they're given this kind of privileged position. In other societies, like in Pacific Islanders, these people are given the chance to be high status females, more or less. They're identified as something between male or female. They're given more of a female role, but they're in charge of all the females in their family group. And this is true in the South Pacific and in other aspects of the Pacific Islands. So you see different things in different cultures, and the history of this is really pretty interesting. So you can check out how that's all gone down over time.
It seems like the most common association with intersexuality is the mythical figure of the hermaphrodite.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it is that image that has permeated the way that we understand this condition to be. How does the intersex society today relate to this somewhat archaic image?
Well, the image is first inaccurate. There is no baby that's ever going to be born with male and female genitals. There's only one set of cells, and it's either going to develop into male or female or something in between. Okay? So you're not going to get a kid with both things because you don't have those kinds of cells in the embryo. It's just not possible. So the myth is literally something that's not possible. We're not going to get a kid that is that has both sets of genitals and is half male, half female. There are very, very rare individuals that have a breast on one side, a flat chest on the other side, an ovary on one side, a testis on the other side, where they do look split in the middle. Okay? But they don't have, they have ambiguous genitalia. They don't have a penis on one side and a vagina on the other. So that, those rare individuals that you'll see kind of in sideshows and circuses or in other places where we display freaks of human nature, those people are seen as the evidence for that ancient mythology around the union of Hermes and Aphrodite.
We come back to the idea of allowing the body of a baby that is born intersex to develop. Is it as simple as that? Is there no need for medical treatment? Or I suppose it depends on the specific syndrome. But can somebody just simply wait and not have to go through the medical establishment up to a point in which a decision can be made?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. That there are a few medically necessary considerations around kids who are born with a hormonal imbalance that causes them to waste all the salt out of their system, and they would die rapidly if they didn't get hormonal intervention, right? So that's one type. Almost all of the rest of the intersex kids, when we do changes on them, we force changes on them, it's cosmetic. It's all cosmetic. And not one doctor you interview is going to tell you that it is medically necessary, except for the discomfort of the parents, or how the kid's going to be accepted in society, right? So they've got this idea that they're going to fix this kid up so they look right. But medical considerations from the standpoint of the health of the child, just the health of the child, there are only a few very, very specific considerations with intersex kids that we can find out pretty quick and treat relatively easily. So all the rest of it is about how we think these kids are supposed to look so that everybody else will be comfortable with them.
So how do you respond to this, if I may call it so, a kind of moral authority of the medical establishment when it is not supposed to be concerned with moral issues?
Well, what happens is that hundreds of thousands of adults will write to their previous treating physicians and will write to medical colleges and the places where nurses and birthing suite employees and all these people are trained, and they'll say, this bad thing happened to us and it didn't work. And you should stop doing this because it's a big mistake. Okay? So because they thought these kids were fixed and they were done with them, they never checked on them as adults. When they do check on them as adults, they can't find them because they committed suicide. Or when they do find them, they're murderously angry at what was done to them. A lot of the time. Some of these people, you know, kind of like seem to have not really noticed and want to just kind of hide out and not even be known as having ever been intersexed. And that is a percentage of the population. But a very large, very, very vocal group is saying, we were cut on, we were scarred, we were made into something that doesn't fit for who we are. It was unfair to do that to us, and you shouldn't do that to kids now.
It seems to me that we live in a society, and I would even claim that this is an international standard, that is completely gender variant phobic, in a sense. Like whatever doesn't fit the binary logic is excluded and made to be seen as a minor thing.
Well, also, they try to eliminate it. They do the best they can to make it go away.
So along these lines, if we continue with the scenario of the baby that is going to wait until he or she can make a decision later on, what is the fate of this baby in a society that is completely phobic to this type of difference? And how can you tackle those issues from childhood or from...
Well, you make sense that the child gets to make all these choices. The child has the chance to be able to find out, where is it easiest for me to be accepted? Where are the societies that do allow for a third gender? Where are the laws really in favor of people like me, right? So they find out things like the country of Colombia in South America. Their Congress made a blanket decision that said, no more surgeries on infants, no more genital surgery on infants. Can't do it. It's against the law. If you do that, you lose your medical license. So we're looking for more laws like that. Okay? When the U.S. Congress issued this general condemnation of female circumcision that is done by Muslim clerics in order to change the nature of the sexuality of the females within their group, well, you know, the men in Congress thought that was just a terrible thing and should be stopped right away. But when we pointed out to them this happens many times every day to American-born kids who don't really need it, we're doing it because we want to change how they look, just like the Muslim clerics, they didn't want to hear that. And they didn't want to see the very direct association between those two forms of logic. So there's the hypocrisy, and it comes right out of this heteronormative subjugation of females kind of consideration. When these kids are growing up, they can choose to dress as male as they like or as female as they like. They get to make that choice. They can dress mixed. If they choose to dress mixed, then they find places where that's acceptable. They can do that in New York City. They can do that in San Francisco. There are plenty of other places where, mostly as teenagers and young adults, it's okay to dress in a mixed fashion. As they settle into whatever kind of style they want to make their own, they'll find their way, and they'll find their way on the basis of all these internet-based international organizations that give lots of advice about, if you want to live like this, you can be here, or you can associate with these people, or have the support of these kinds of groups. For the families, there's plenty of psychologists, plenty of other lay therapists who can come to these families and say, here's how you make this adjustment. Here's how you make this easiest on you and easiest on this kid. Here's how you don't have to reject your own child as they become a young adult and make the choice not to be something that everybody thinks is normal.
Can you speak to me about the political organization of intersex people in the United States? How has that come to be? What are the types of organizations that have been formed? What is the type of lobbying that is being done to the higher powers in government, etc.?
We mostly have organized into groups of people that naturally the medical establishment wants to refer to as troublemakers and activists and people who are doing more harm than good, who are actually making it harder for them to do good work and are making it harder for young kids who need this treatment to get access to the treatment that they really need. So, of course, this is what you'd expect the establishment to be able to say. So if you look at something like the Intersex Society of North America, or if you look at the androgen insensitivity groups or the CAH groups or any of the groups around the world that have organized to offer support to one another. There are lots and lots of trans family associations and trans family unity groups that are trying to offer similar kinds of services to kids who identify as not being the sex they were born in, even though they don't have ambiguous genitalia, even though they don't have differences in their chromosomes or hormones that our science is able to detect at this time in our scientific development. My guess is very clear that with trans kids, we're going to know what it is later. We're just not smart enough to know what it is now. Okay? So I don't think it's going to be that different. Either way, there's lots and lots of these support groups in, you know, pretty much all over the world, and you can find them on the internet anytime you want. So those are the people who we send anxious parents to, and who we send teenagers to, and who we send adults who have been isolated, have never had relationships, have been hiding in jobs where they don't have to meet other people for years. We send these people to find these support groups first, and then they may be part of the groups that lobby the American Academy of Pediatrics, or lobby the American Medical Association, or speak to Congress people about the laws to change things so that standards of care and informed consent is something that becomes the law for little kids, including infants, as opposed to just adults. So these are the kinds of things that are happening right now.
Has there been any legislative resolution to any of these lobbying strategies that you are mentioning?
Outside of the big win in Colombia, not that I can point at right now. I can say the American Academy of Pediatrics in the early part of the new century released a much more reasonable paper statement about how people should treat intersex kids. But you have to become a lawyer to understand the difference between should and must. Should means you can do whatever you like. We think you ought to do it this way, which means wait and be sure about surgery. Must means you must wait and be sure about surgery. Otherwise, you can lose your license or be sued by the parents who later are dissatisfied with the fact that they've got this kid who's been made into a little girl who's saying all along, I'm a boy, I want to be a boy, I want my penis, I want my penis back, I want a new penis. You know, they won't wear short hair, or they won't wear long hair, they won't wear dresses, they won't play with dolls. You know, that's a mistake. That's a mistake somebody made because they didn't look at all the facts, and the facts are known. So, you know, when you look at those kinds of problems, it's like, well, what do we do? What do we do with those kinds of confusion? So I appreciate the American Academy of Pediatrics said, you ought to wait. But what happened is that everybody said, oh, that's interesting. And then they kept doing what they were taught to do when they were in medical school. No change occurred that I'm aware of.
There hasn't been any, not even a hint of interest from the part of the U.S. states, the United States Congress, or the government in these issues?
Nope. Actually, when the hypocrisy of the female circumcision statement came out in Congress, and we brought this to them, and they said, look, you're talking about genital surgery on kids that shouldn't be done. You were willing to do this for Muslim kids in Saudi Arabia. Why aren't you willing to do this for American kids in every American city in this country every day? And we ran into this thing around religious traditions behind circumcision. And it's a big blockage. Because if we issue this blanket statement that says you can't do genital surgery on infants without their consent, well, what do we do about circumcision? Well, the answer isn't that hard. The answer is very simple. We do it in the way that's been done for thousands and thousands of years. It's done by somebody who is part of that religious organization. It isn't done by every doctor in every hospital on every male child that is born. It's easy, but they make it hard.
I am from Colombia, actually. I was following the regulation. It's not the Congress. It's a little bit different in Colombia. The advancement of these laws actually are a bit different in Colombia because they're ruled by the Constitutional Court.
Right.
So
yes.
It is if it was going through the Congress, which is an incredibly Catholic institution, mm-hmm. it would have never passed. Mm-hmm. But the Constitutional Court is a little bit more open-minded. In fact, there is a lawsuit right now, I think in the next week, they mm-hmm. have to resolve whether they're going to accept gay marriage.
Good.
Being intersex has technically nothing to do with sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. Yet, there seems to be a proximity between the intersex community and the LGBT organizations. Can you speak about this? Why does this eye suddenly, or this the tear in the eye, suddenly fit into this political organization? And has this alliance served politically for the intersex society?
Okay, it's a couple of big questions. Yes. Sociologically, the gay and lesbian community has for a very long time, or actually I should say, the artist community has for a very long time been the place where people who are sexually different go to. Right? These are people who identify as being counterculture. They're different than the mainstream. And that's why I talk about the people who I see as being sexually different. They're different than the mainstream. So whenever people who are different from the mainstream are looking for a place where they'll be accepted, as opposed to receiving prejudice and being kept down and being refused privilege and being kept from being able to advance in the things that are most important to them, they go to these fringe communities. Well, lesbians and gays have won a lot of recognition in this society, in Western society, certainly not in a lot of Eastern societies, but we're at a place where lesbians and gays really have a political force now. So queer others and sexually different others do get some value out of associating themselves with these groups. The lesbian gay community has been pretty willing to accept people who are sexually different, like the heterosexual sadomasochistic types and all the rest of the people who are sexually different and express their sexuality in a different way. So cross-gender kinds of behavior from the standpoint of what the mainstream sees as the sexual binary almost always gravitates toward the gay and lesbian subculture and community. And there is some power in that. It's power in numbers. And there's political organizations that are already established, and they already have their inroads with the various powers that be and with a lot of the corporations that have the money to support that kind of pursuit. So is that a good or a bad thing? I can't really be sure. From the standpoint of the sexuality of the intersex person, I ask this question a lot when I'm being interviewed about that, because if I identify as intersex, and I do, then homosexuality is the bad thing, right? We don't want to be homosexual. So if I'm intersexed, when is it that I'm homosexual? Am I homosexual when I sleep with a male partner because I happen to look male? Or am I homosexual when I sleep with a female partner because I'm really intersexed, I'm not female? Am I only homosexual when I sleep with another intersex person? And how do we define that? How do we make sure that's really an intersex person so we can be sure that I'm really homosexual? So, you know, from the standpoint of the gay and lesbian movement, are intersex people just more homosexuals jumping on the bandwagon? Well, no. It's kind of hard given our very strict definitions that are completely gender biased and binary. What's the sexuality of an intersex person if they don't identify as male or female? And, you know, we all get to look at these definitional questions when we try to make sense of how we're going to arrange our prejudices.
And that's a really interesting question. So you're suggesting that sexuality along those lines is culturally constructed?
Absolutely. I don't suggest it. Okay. I don't suggest it. I say that's the truth of it.
Speak to me about the cultural representation of the intersex in the United States. And if any of the organizations that you are associated with, how do they tackle these issues? Because traditionally, as from what we were speaking about, this the image of the hermaphrodite is also made to believe as a kind of freak, right? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that in a sense, renaming the hermaphrodite to intersex is an attempt at demythologizing this identity, in a sense. Is this correct? And what is the cultural representation of the intersex today in the United States?
Well, of course, like everything else, there's a pretty broad array. I think different people and different organizations feel differently about just how that should be done. There are, of course, within any group, there are differences. So there are some of us, like me, who feel that intersex is an accurate term between the sexes. And that's the way that we want to be able to knock down the binary. It isn't just one, it isn't just this or that, it's all this in between. So we're the intersex people. We're the ones who are in between, right? And that makes sense to me if you look at the basics of pulling apart that word and making sense of the etymology, right? So intersex is the one that makes sense to me. It's the one that fits. It's a lot better than hermaphrodite because hermaphrodite doesn't exist. It isn't real. Some people felt that intersex had certain meanings that they didn't want to be associated with. And so they chose this other naming, which is called DSD, which is a disorder of sexual development. So there are a lot of people out there that stopped using intersex and now claim that they have a disorder of sexual development, or that these babies have a disorder of sexual development. It makes this more scientific. It also makes it more medical. I'm afraid that it makes it more treatable as a result. I'm afraid it makes it more of a stigma. I have a disorder, than intersex does, which I think is an identity. I'd prefer to have an identity as an intersex person than an identity as a disordered person.
One of the people I interviewed in Norway, Esben Esther Pirelle Benestad, who's a trans activist, speaks, doesn't like the disorder categorization either, and here speaks about talents, that being trans is a matter of being of having a talent.
Yes.
It's a talent that needs to be enacted and performed.
Right. Yeah. And beautifully said. And that's part of the other thing that I want to respond to regarding cultural representation. I'm intersexed, right? But I made a choice very young. I pass as male really well. And if I keep my hair really short and I keep my body muscular and lean and I have this big square jaw and I grow hair on my face, and I'm a doctor, right? I get a lot of cultural privileges for being a white male doctor who's in good shape with hyper-masculine appearance and all the other stuff that goes along with how I dress every day. Okay? That's all a choice. And I get something for making that choice. So I act this male gender stuff really, really well. And it's kind of fun. I know it's a joke. Right?
Can you speak about that? Why? How is it a joke?
Well, it's not true. You know, like your friend says, it's a talent. I get to dress up like this. I get to cut my hair like this. I get to exercise to keep my body like this. And I do so because of the effect that it has on the projection of everyone who looks at or meets me or sees me in media. So when I'm sitting in a media position and somebody's seeing me on some TV show or something, and I say, I am not male, they look at this image, right? They look at this image and they think, that's not male. And then, you know, you really kind of like have to make some sense of that. What does that mean? If that's not male, and I don't look anything like that, I'm supposed to be a real man. What do I do then? If I can't measure up to that appearance, and he's not male, and I am, well, what does that mean?
If you say it's not true, but in your appearance, it is self-evident that it is true, that you are a hyper-masculine...
Intersex person.
But wouldn't that be reducing the idea of what gender is to a kind of biological statement? In other words, you are intersex in terms of your biological
makeup,
mm-hmm. but you aren't intersex in the way that you're presenting yourself to the world. Speak about that.
That's a cultural construction.
Correct.
That's a cultural construction. That's about what we want to believe through our eyes. That's about how we make things look. We've agreed that this appearance is masculine. Gender is masculine. Sex is male. Right?
But when you say it's not true, what would be true?
Well, if what would be true is that I would have a nice intersex presentation. I could wear softer clothes. I wouldn't have to be this heavily muscled. I wouldn't have to act out all the male typical stuff in order to have power and position. Wouldn't that be great? But the fact is that in order to have power and position, I get a better chance at it if I act out all the heavy male stuff. That's the truth. I dare anybody to refute that.
No, I wouldn't. It seems like you are an incredibly self-confident and assertive political person.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of us are like this.
No.
What are the alternatives and choices that intersex kids can make when they're growing up, in order to have a life that is dignified and not one of rejection and discrimination and so on?
Well, there's no way any of us can make choices to lead a life where we are not rejected and discriminated against. I don't care how privileged and mainstream you are, you're still going to expect to have some rejection, some limitation. So we can't eliminate that. We can make individual choices about how far we want to go in politicizing our statement. I haven't always been so willing to adhere to these heteronormative gender appearances. As I got more power as a result of my education, my degree, my experience, the institutions I became associated with, it was much safer for me to come out and say the things that I'm saying to you today. Previous to my having the backing of those institutions, all those degrees, all those years of study, all that expertise, I could have been doing myself a lot of harm by saying this stuff. But because I did the work to have that position, I can defend myself much more effectively. For other people who don't have that kind of privilege of professional development and background, they take a lot more risk. If I want to go out into the job world and represent myself as somebody who's available to become, you know, an executive in a corporation, and they saw me on TV saying I'm not a man, going to be hard to get hired. Going to be hard to get hired. Okay? So I have to balance that. I've chosen a life where I'm in charge of my office, and I work for myself, and I see my own clients, and they come to me, and thank goodness they pay me enough to be able to pay for my life. But if I didn't do that in this society, I could be in big trouble for doing the stuff that I do and for saying the things that I say. So I think that we have to be careful about our choices, about how it is that we represent ourselves in a very public way, depending upon the kind of success we want to have. I think that people like me and people who are gender outrageous and people who are politically very rebellious and radical in their gender presentation, I applaud them. I need them to be out on the street. I need them to be doing that as long as they can afford to do it. I need them to find lives where they can continue to do that kind of gender politics with their physical appearance and with their outspoken views. And I know that at one point or another, not all of them are going to be able to find a way to make a living where they can still maintain that identity and that appearance. And many of them, and I've listened to them, have to tone that down in order to be able to survive economically in this society. And that's too bad. And what I'm hoping is that enough of this kind of work will make it possible for those people to be acceptable in the workplace. We still can't get gender demonstration, gender appearance, to be taken out of the discrimination laws. Congress won't do it in this country. I've been working for years with GPAC to make that happen. They'll take out sexual orientation, but they won't take out gender different appearance. No. And we're hoping that'll happen, but it hasn't happened yet.
Is the intersex society working together with the transgender groups? Because it seems in the way that you're speaking about this in terms of presentation, and that is much closer to gender identity disorders,
yes,
than it is to sexual orientation issues.
Right. As you know, gender identity disorders is a term that's about to be thrown out.
Right.
So, you know, that one's going to go away because the scientists said so. Like homosexuality went away in 1973. So our terminology is going to be changing. Nevertheless, there are people who are intersex who don't want to be called transsexual. That's like a bad word to them. And they don't like that association.
How do you feel about it yourself?
Again, I think there's strength in numbers. I think we're fighting for a lot of the same things. I think we're stupid not to associate. I think we need to be able to bring the rights of gender different, sexually different people forward. And I don't care if you identify as intersex or transsex or queer or gender different. I don't care. I think that as a group, we need to be able to work together, bring our money together, bring our organizations together to make this change happen within the larger society. As long as we're jealous and fighting about turf within this kind of a movement, it's going to be very hard for progress to occur.
One of the motivations for me to work on this project, and in fact, its title is derived from that desire, which is We Who Feel Differently, is to come back to the idea of difference and not to keep on asserting the idea of equality. Because, I mean, I have privileges because of my upbringing and so on, and I am also a homosexual man, which in a way it's highly more acceptable than any other forms of sexual orientation or gender identity. But at the same time, I do want to live a different life, and I am completely opposed to the way that even the gay and lesbian movement is shaping my representation.
Good.
In that sense. Can you speak to me about, I mean, you've already done it, but I would like to get a sense, like a statement from you about this idea of difference.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
We are gender different. We're not equal. I don't want to be like heterosexuals, ever. It's the last thing I want. Otherwise, I would have been heterosexual, right? Like I had a choice. I don't want to have the rights that heterosexuals have. I want to have the rights that other human beings have. Right? We're different, but we're not different, meaning that we should be subjugated, separated, destroyed, discriminated against, the objects of prejudice. None of that. We are good human beings. Really, we're good human beings. And these rights have to be extended to all human beings, not just heterosexuals. Right? So I need this to be seen as absolutely, as you just said it, we are different. We're going to be different. We're going to look different. We're going to feel different. We're going to sound different. We're going to speak differently. We're going to have different activities on the weekends. When we get together, in the corporate coffee lounge, we're going to talk about different stuff than our heterosexual workmates who have kids in school. Okay, unless we have kids too. And the fact is that that difference is never going to go away. It's not. So saying that we're equal or that we're the same is silly. It's not going to happen that way. Marriage equality is one of those places where I get really caught up because I'm very concerned about the nature of both of those terms. I'm not so sure that marriage is so great for heterosexuals, let alone for everybody else. And I don't think that equality is really what we're looking for there. I think what we're looking for is equal access to the privileges that laws that people who are married get. That's what we really want. The rest of it has nothing to do with identity, nothing to do with gender, nothing to do with biology, nothing to do with science. It just has to do with taxes.
Throughout some of these conversations that I've been having, especially with leaders of the gay and lesbian movements in organizations in different places, one of the arguments, counter arguments to what you just said, for example, is that most gay and lesbian people want to have normal lives, quote unquote. They want to live in the suburb, have a family, be able to marry, and so on. Are you and I a minority in that regard? Do you and I want to live differently, but everybody else wants to live a certain life? Or do you find that to be just a political manipulation from the part of these people?
Well, I've been around this for a long time. And I've been listening to certain very well-known leaders talking about how we're just like you, right? And it's not true. How many gay couples do you know that live in the suburbs and want children? And like, and go to the local country club and PTA. I don't know a lot of those. I think gay people like to be around other gay people. A lot. So I don't see a massive exodus of all gay people from city centers where they tend to put themselves, or cultural centers where they tend to put themselves, because a lot of gay people have real interest in culture because they see how they do and don't fit into culture. I don't see us all, you know, making some kind of mass move out to the suburbs to take over gay neighborhoods like there's an Italian neighborhood, or there's a black neighborhood, or there's a wealthy neighborhood. I just don't see it that way. I don't see that happening. I don't see that happening this century or next century. So I think it's what's called a specious argument. It sounds good, but it's not right. It may sell, but it is not the way things are going to happen.
Is there anything that I haven't asked or that you would like to bring forth a bit more at this moment?
Interviewers will often make statements with me about how reducing the binary orientation toward sexuality is going to lead to a sexless society, a genderless society, and how that's going to be some kind of advancement within human culture and human development, and it's going to change everything and make us all into equals, so that we neither regard ourselves as male or female, and we don't see ourselves as having hierarchy or power on that basis. And I think that there's an interesting utopian idea behind that. But as I said just a few minutes ago, I don't think we're moving toward a great leavening. I don't think we're moving toward a great sameness here. I think what we're really going to be doing is learning to celebrate difference in all of its forms, as opposed to making sense of how it is that we can separate and discriminate against difference over time. I don't see difference reducing. I see difference increasing and being given space to be expressed, as opposed to suppressed and eliminated.